from deep inside your radio.
So deep inside, ladies and gentlemen, that you can't even imagine. But we'll get into that. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, if you're in Boston, dubious. If you're going to Boston, possible. If you're in the, I don't know. If you're fixing to go somewhere, and it could be Boston, Teddy Bear's Picnic is playing at the Coolidge Corner Cinema in Boston right now. I just have to say that because otherwise I don't say that. The British press today has a letter. This didn't make the American news. Hard to believe. A letter from Osama bin Laden. I'm serious. The London Sunday Observer. Full text of a letter, presumably from Osama bin Laden, translated into English for your listening pleasure. My favorite, you know, it's nothing you don't know, but it's news, I guess, when he writes a letter. Because he doesn't write, I don't think he writes to his mom, I hear. So he wrote a letter to some guy in Britain who is or is not an Islamic fundamentalist. Jury is out. And, of course, there is no jury. But my favorite sentence in the letter from Osama bin Laden, and he's directing this basically to America. This is, I guess, for years, Alastair Cook has had a show on the BBC called Letter from America. This is Osama bin Laden's letter to America, and it contains the following sentence. Quote, "It is saddening to tell you that you are the worst civilization witnessed by the history of mankind." Unquote. It's saddening. It makes him, that's why the eyes are sad, because he's got to tell us that. The worst civilization witnessed by the history of man. Now, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I bowed to no one in my critique of modern American civilization, but I do bow. Only in that sense, only in the most rhetorical sense, please don't misunderstand. Because I wouldn't even. You know, I think you could, if you did the research, if you weren't sitting in a cave, find worse civilizations. Just a guess. And because basically the best thing you can do for yourself under most circumstances when trouble strikes is take a placebo. It's been confirmed by medical scientists that in many, many, many cases, placebos work as well or better than, quote, real, unquote, medication. Now comes this. In regard to the varying effectiveness of different kinds of placebos, capsules containing colored beads are more effective than colored tablets, which are superior to white tablets with corners, which have better results than round white tablets. Beyond this, intramuscular saline injections of placebo, that's saline, just salt water, are superior to any tablet, but inferior to intravenous injections. Tablets taken from a bottle labeled with a well-known brand name are superior to the same tablets taken from a bottle with a typed label. There was a doctor who always handled placebo tablets with forceps, assuring the patient that they were too powerful to be touched by hand. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your radio placebo. Hello, welcome to the show. This one is rounded, but with colored beads.
Sunlight blinking. Cypress knees lay shadow steps in front of Jacob and me, as if we're guided by the heaven's eye on the ladder road down to the living town. Quick as lightning, news is frightening. Caleb, my neighbor, where you running? Yelling thunder, the prophets have not blundered. The great locks are opening soon.
The
the sand eyes are sinking low. Whoa, they rock in the cradle, the song they rock by and roll out the red carpet on the edge of the light, and we'll stake the blue river and rejoice in style. Break out a bottle of fine gulping wine and raise cane down in the living town. I heard old Moses was hired to go by the Corps of Engineers to run this show. And out of the basin, two by two, and just last Noah, he knows what to do. The river is high and the sandbags are sinking low. Whoa, they rock in the cradle, and someday the rock will buy him. Chunks on the mossy drapes. So pull back the curtain, the devil be damned. Into the fog we will make our stand. But the word gets around, so don't be surprised at who shows up down in the levee town. The river is high and the sandbags are sinking low. Someday a rock will buy and roll out the red carpet on the edge of a light, and we'll snake the blue river and rejoice in style. Break out a bottle of fine gulping wine and raise cane down. Roll out the red carpet on the edge of a light, and we'll snake the blue river and rejoice in style. Break out a bottle of fine gulping wine and raise cane down in the living town.
When the last time I saw you, you wouldn't even kiss me. That rich guy you've been seeing must have put you down. So welcome back, baby, to the poor side of town. To him, you were nothing but a little plaything.
Just a plaything.
Not much more than an overnight fling. But to me, you were the greatest thing I've ever found. And it's hard to find a good thing on the poor side of town. I don't blame you for trying. I've been trying to make it too, but I've got one little hang up, baby. I can't make it without you. So won't you tell me, are you gonna stay now? Stand by me all the way now. With you by my side, the world can't do us down. And together we can make it out of the poor side of town.
Do 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 ah, shoo do me. Do 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 ah, shoo me.
The world can't do us down, and together we can make it, darling, from the poor side of town. The poor side of town. The poor side of town. Oh, take my hand, don't be afraid. Together we can make it done from the poor side of town.
Shooby dooby, everybody. Hello, welcome to the show from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, back in the world headquarters of the show. I love how they trumpet that news broadcast from ABC World Headquarters. Well, you mean where you got the studio? Just drop the thing, babe. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, you sharp-eared listeners may recall last week's broadcast originated from New York City, just for the love and the joy, but also because a little television show that I'm a member of the cast of which I'm a member of the cast, the cast was invited to be on another television program. I know, it's just all television, called Inside the Actor's Studio, which tapes in New York. So we flew there and sat for 5.5 hours. But it'll be edited down to a nifty 90 minutes or something when it airs in February. But I have a little insight, which we might call Inside the Actor's Studio, which is that, of course, as at every performance and television program, there's a green room. near the stage for the actors, the performers, to hang out before they go on stage, to adjust their makeup and other thing. You know, the mirrors and lights and things. And of course, a restroom. Since it's, you know, backstage and it's not a lot of room there, it's a unisex bathroom. And when you walk in, when I walked in, closed the door, there was a little sign on the inside of the door, which said, quote, "Lock doesn't work. Sorry for the inconvenience," unquote. Now, A, you'd think that sign would be on both sides of the door. Because B, since it's not, having somebody from the, let's just make up a hypothetical sex, the opposite sex, having somebody from that sex walk in while you're seated, enough said, department? I wouldn't classify that as an inconvenience. You know, the soap dispenser doesn't work. That's an inconvenience you're sorry for. This is something else. Anyway, they're sorry for it. We'll get to more apologies later in the broadcast. Actors in U.S. sitcoms and drama series are speaking more words per minute than ever before in a bid to make their characters appear more intelligent and appeal to younger viewers. This is from a British newspaper, of course. Scriptwriters on some of America's biggest TV shows have upped the word count significantly because they believe the faster characters speak, the more intelligent viewers perceive them to be. You do know, parenthetically, ladies and gentlemen, we're the slowest talking. We may not be the worst civilization in the history of mankind. We are the slowest talking. I mean, really. That's why we have such trouble with foreign languages. They talk so fast. Hollywood producers, back to the story, also believe rapid-fire conversation, often while characters are on the move, is popular among the MTV generation of viewers. Which generation would that be now? Thing has been on for more than 20 years. They've even hired dialogue coaches to help actors keep pace with the increased word rate. This, according to the Wall Street Journal. Aaron Sorkin from The West Wing described the speed at which characters speak as, quote, turbo fast. He told the Wall Street Journal, "My parents will call me every Wednesday night and say, 'Great show, tell them to talk slower.'" Bill Lawrence, the creator and executive producer of Scrubs, said quick-fire dialogue and short, snappy scenes were, quote, "a humor insurance policy. If someone doesn't think one scene is funny, another one is coming right away," he said. Well, there's your guarantee right there. From the same people who brought you that last unfunny short scene, here comes the next one. You gotta love that. The phenomenon can be seen in other U.S. dramas. In Gilmore Girls, so-called fast talk makes a small-town setting feel hip. In American Dreams, the characters talk quickly over the family dinner table to appeal to teenage viewers. Amy Sherman-Palladino, the creator and executive producer of Gilmore Girls, said the show avoided using close-up shots because the technique slows down the dialogue. She added the actors were encouraged to walk and talk to save time. You've seen Dan Rather do that. It looks so good. Moonlighting is thought to be the first show to use fast-track dialogue when it featured quick-fire exchanges between the two stars. The practice has its drawbacks, however. This British newspaper reports the number of takes required to complete each scene is said to have rocketed. Me, I gotta be dumb, I guess, the pace at which I'm talking. But, you know, this show's for the old folks, isn't it? "Dear Harry," writes an anonymous tipster, who insists on being anonymous. This is apropos of the protests that networks are making about local stations digitally compressing network shows so that the local stations can squeeze in more ad time. The networks are getting all huffy about it. "Dear Harry, I thought you might be interested to know that the WB show, Everwood, has aired at least once in Verispeed mode," in other words, the compression scheme you spoke of, "to shorten the program material and add more commercial content, was utilized on the network level." I don't know if this is illegal, the correspondent adds, but it seems greedy. Oh, come on. Seems. This is interesting. Researcher, this is from, again, let's get scared. Sunday British newspaper from The Observer, researchers have developed a technique to speed evolution. Yeah, that's my beef with evolution. It ain't going fast enough. You know, I want to see it in action. I want to see the end. Have developed a technique to speed evolution by inserting humor cancer-causing genes into animals and plants. What harm could that do? We've all tried that at home. Hundreds of mutant breeds, which would normally take nature millennia to produce, could be developed in months by the method known as hypermutability. It's like talking fast, only more so. But the technique designed to improve production of new animal and crop breeds has shocked many scientists and environmentalists, and some say the process could result in organisms with humor cancer-causing genes being released into the environment. Others worry that attempts to accelerate evolution could be dangerous. No, I don't. I think that, you know. However, its creator, U.S.-based company Morphotech, says it could be valuable to drug and agriculture companies, making it possible to isolate highly profitable breeds, drought-resistant plants, or milk-rich cows. Details of the method were passed to the British newspaper The Observer last week by a senior British researcher working for one of Europe's largest biotech corporations. He's a keen supporter of genetic modification technology. The scientist was dismayed to learn about Morphotech's plans after its directors launched a sales tour of Europe. "I was completely shocked," he said. "What would happen if an organism containing such a dangerous gene escaped? What if a gene got into the food chain? Some people could suffer fatal reactions." I read his quote fast to make it seem young. The method involves the isolation of a gene involved in repairing DNA. Some people inherit a version. This gets complicated. Nicholas Nicolaides, chief executive of Morphotech, said the work was safe. "When a mutant breed with commercial opportunity was found, it would be simple to breed out the cancer-causing gene," he said. Adding, "We are not using animals for this process at this time, just mammalian cells," unquote. At this time. That's very reassuring. And now it's another time. Harbor officials paint a bleak picture of security at Long Beach Harbor. Yeah. You know, this week we learned that Los Angeles is once again the murder capital of the United States. Thank you, gangs. Thank you very much. Now we learn that Long Beach Harbor, which is part of the local harbor complex, has no efficient system to screen out cargo containers and other lapses that make the port vulnerable to a possible attack. The Orange County Register reports today port officials are worried about containers being delivered to port by semi-tractor trailer rigs that have been susceptible to possible terrorist infiltration. Other problems include a shortage of police patrols and surveillance cameras, so trespassers can wander about unnoticed. Hazardous chemicals are stored above ground, and there's no system for providing evacuation information. The vulnerabilities are in an 84-page request submitted to the U.S. government in March asking for more money. Long Beach port officials sought more than $70 million in security funds. They got from the federal government to deal with these problems $6 million. A dime on the dollar, ladies and gentlemen. An additional $125 million in security grants for ports around the nation was approved by Congress this month. But federal transportation officials are still deciding how and where to distribute the money. Meanwhile, Senator Graham of Florida, the Democrat who's been heading the Intelligence Committee, is going all over the TV and in the press saying, you know, if we do attack, we're about 60 days away from attacking Saddam, and if we do, that's when all terrorist hell breaks loose. We better be ready for it. Because what does Saddam have to lose at that point? Gee, wasn't that question raised somewhere else earlier? Yes, it was. And to those Democrats who take great joy in deriding President Bush for pronouncing the word nuclear, so does Senator Graham, and he's a Democrat. There you go. Now, ladies and gentlemen, maybe we should. Maybe we should go on the warpath against a country that's giving refuge to Osama bin Laden and that's helping North Korea build its nuclear weapons. What do you think? No, it's not Iraq. It's our good buddy Pakistan. Last July, American intelligence agencies tracked a Pakistani cargo aircraft as it landed in a North Korean airfield and took on a secret payload, ballistic missile parts, the chief export of North Korea's military. The shipment, brazen in full view of American spy satellites, part of the transport was an American-built C-130. Part of the force, President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan told President Bush last year would be devoted to hunting down the terrorists of Al-Qaeda. Several times since that new alliance was cemented, reports the New York Times, American intelligence agencies have been watching as Pakistan's air fleet conducted a deadly barter with North Korea. The North provided Pakistan with missile parts he needs to build a nuclear arsenal capable of reaching every strategic site in India. Pakistan provided North Korea with many of the designs for gas centrifuges and much of the machinery it needs to make highly enriched uranium for that country's nuclear weapons project, one intended to put at risk South Korea and Japan and 100,000 American troops in Northeast Asia. CIA told Congress this week North Korea's uranium program, which the CIA only discovered this summer, good morning, will produce enough material to produce weapons in 2 to 3 years. Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen. What do you think? No, they're our friend. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. It is Tales of Airport Security. Dear Harry, the time is a dreary overcast Saturday morning at the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. I had to travel to Anchorage to work on a 6 a.m. flight and was supposed to meet someone for a ride outside the baggage claim area of the Anchorage Airport. She wasn't there, so I waited and waited. From the time I began to wait, two pieces of very typical-looking luggage were left alone near the curb at this drive-through pickup area. They were small, normal pieces, but were there when I arrived and no one was around. Because they were near a comfortable bench, I sat down near them. Anyone chancing upon the scene could easily assume they were mine. But I waited for 45 minutes, during which time several uniformed security personnel passed by me or looked outside the doors of the airport, saw the luggage, saw me, saw my luggage, but never asked me or even feigned suspicion that the luggage wasn't mine. Finally, a woman in a uniform came over to the luggage, looked at it rather carefully, and asked me about it. I said it wasn't mine, and that it had been there for at least 45 minutes, but I had no idea whom it belonged to. Still, she didn't confiscate it, but went to get another uniformed guard to discuss it. Then finally came back and removed the two bags, saying to me that if anyone came by to claim the bags, that security had them. Dear Harry, I now have become an unofficial part of the training of airport screeners. I have a prosthesis on my left arm and my artificial hand has metal in it. So ever since they first started using metal detectors at airports, I've been setting them off. In the pre-9/11 days, some of the screeners felt a little sorry for me and many times only gave me a cursory once-over. One time I was working on a project in Tucson that required me to fly back and forth to Tucson for 8 weeks. After about the fourth week, the screeners in Tucson recognized me and would just wave me through the screening area. This would sometimes amaze colleagues traveling with me. They would say that I would make the perfect smuggler. After 9/11, my hand started getting a little closer scrutiny, but after the shoe bomber, my hand got much closer scrutiny. At JFK, the screener was going to make me take my arm off so he could send it through the X-ray. Fortunately, a supervisor came over and decided it was not necessary. On October 11th, I was flying from LAX to Dulles. That's the first weekend of the new federal screeners. I arrived at LAX at 5 a.m. and was greeted by a sea of new screeners in new uniforms. Of course, I set off the metal detector. I was ushered over to a chair and told to take everything out of my pockets and take my shoes off. I explained about my prosthesis and got the deer in the headlights look. He called over the supervisor, and I became a training moment. The supervisor explained in great detail what to do, e.g., ask if you may touch his arm. I was sure glad I got to the airport early. Flying back from Dulles, it was the same routine. Ushered to the chair, off with the shoes, the deer in the headlight look, and the supervisor's detailed instructions. By the way, I'm not complaining. I know these guys have a job to do, although I do wish they would use the same approach as the Tokyo airport, where young women wearing white gloves gave me a full-body pat-down. Dear Harry, I'm sending in this story for my brother. He edits a medical journal. Here's his story. Quote, I was working at a medical convention out of town. At the hotel, I was using a box knife to unpack literature. When I got done, I put the box knife in my carry-on bag and brought it up to my room. When I went through the airport security check later, they x-rayed my bag and even made me take off my belt. They found nothing. Waiting at the gate in the secured part of the airport, I went to get something out of my bag and found the box knife. I carefully weighed my options. I definitely didn't want to bring the knife on the plane where it might cause a panic. I thought of simply holding the knife up and saying in a clear voice, I have a box knife. Instead, I wrapped the box knife in a paper napkin and casually put it in the garbage. Tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature. And you know, Vice President Al Gore has been making the rounds on his flogging his new book. He's been on virtually every show you can imagine, and he'll be on one more moments from now, next on Le Show.
What can I say, dear, after I say I'm sorry? What can I do to prove it to you I'm sorry? I didn't mean to ever be mean to you. If I didn't care, I wouldn't feel like I do. I was all wrong, but right or wrong, I don't blame you. Why should I take somebody like you and shame you? I know I made you cry, and I'm so sorry, dear. What can I say, dear, after I say I'm sorry?
Roger's Christmas in Style, a combination store and galleria, which is just bringing all the best from the world of design into the world of the holidays. And that is a move that must be made from the second floor coffee lounge of Christmas in Style. This is Strictly from Blackwell. I'm Blackwell. And it is our idea that we're going to celebrate these holidays as never before, because there is such darkness in the world and there is such threat of more darkness that we must string up every light. That is what Spencer believes, and I believe it too. And so, and Ronnie Roget believes it, because you have never seen a gold lame Santa suit in 24 karat gold lame until you have been to Christmas in Style. Anyway, Ronnie can do his own, his own plugs. But we think that this is going to be the best Thanksgiving ever. It's going to be the best Christmas ever. It's going to be the best New Year's Eve ever. And then 2003, who knows? You cross your fingers, you cross whatever is still loose enough to cross. It hasn't been tightened to where it can't be crossed. We have good conversation with two wondrous guests. We call him a magician with a pair of scissors. You, if you're very, very lucky, call him Rene of London. And he is here to talk about hair and hairstyles for the holidays and just holidays and hair. But before that, and it's not any comment on Rene London that not first. Because,
well, if he wants,
first is the man who was second. In both, in so many ways, because you were vice president and you almost won the election.
I actually did win the election, okay, if you count the popular vote, thing they forget to do every once in a while.
The popular vote, we love it. Because the popular vote is so much like the People's Choice Awards these days. Uh-huh. You wonder, why don't they just let the Academy choose everybody, including the president? But he is here with a new book and a new outlook and a new attitude and an old wardrobe. Is that?
Well,
Vice President Al Gore, welcome to Strictly.
Thank you very much, Mr. Blackwell. If you're talking about the suit, actually this was bought during the 8 months when I was
hiding,
cocooning after after the 2000 election.
Yeah.
And part of the cocooning was going on a little shopping spree from time to time. Tipper would just do it to get me out of the house.
Interesting.
And this is, who's this, honey? A Hugo Boss?
No, Hugo Boss. In his dreams, they would do that. No, that is a...
Well, let me look here. Yeah, Hugo Boss.
Okay, it is a Hugo Boss. Mm. Interesting that they have gone, walked the whole line upstairs, do we think?
I don't
or just
know.
A segment of the line? That's good conversation for another time. Mr. Vice President, is that what I call you, Your Excellency?
Well, what? No. You know what? I tell this to all the interviewers on the book tour, and nobody really takes it seriously. But I mean it. Call me Al.
No. We'll call you Mr. Al.
Well, I don't...
You're not the talking mule. You're the,
thank
the
you.
Thinking and writing and being and feeling former vice president. Are you still vice? No, you're not still vice president.
I'm former vice president, okay, and I guess you would say titular head of the Democratic Party, although we're blessed with so many great leaders.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say titular head.
Okay.
It's fine. The picture that it brings to my mind is not worth the trip. So you have written a book, mm-hmm, and you are back out in the world.
Yeah.
And what do we think of you, and what do you think of us?
Well, I think the American people are aching for leadership.
Okay, good.
You know, Mr. Blackwell, after September 11th, it only didn't take me more than 2.5 weeks to stand up and say, I am totally in support of our president, George W. Bush,
incredible,
and the way he's responding to
amazing
this crisis and this challenge.
Yeah.
But it's been a year, and
been a year, mm-hmm, that I would like, along with the Queen of England, to forget.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if the other one was an Annus Horribilis, this has got to be just the most painful, burning Annus Horribilis ever.
Well, it's been a challenging year, I think, for this nation to awake.
Tell me about
to
it.
Our vulnerability, mm-hmm, in the world.
Yeah.
But
and with each other.
You know, I think the public is ahead of its leaders in a lot of ways. I think the public, for example, Mr. Blackwell, is ahead of the leaders in saying we want an affordable prescription drug program for our seniors. And, you know, we in the leadership or in the former leadership of the country are racing to catch up.
Yeah. I think we're racing to catch up in so many ways. I think the fashion, mm-hmm, sense of Mrs. Jane Q, I just want to make the statement that I want to make as the woman,
sure,
public,
mm-hmm,
is being chased by somebody of the so-called designers and former designers.
Well, I
want to talk to you about fashion and your fashion sense, because
okay,
there was talk last time we knew you of earth tones
and
polo shirts.
Look,
are you still doing this?
Well, and look, this was...
Can we say one thing?
This was just blown so out of proportion, as so many things are in our current media age.
Everything
is Blackwell.
Everything
I was just, with the advice of Tipper,
hello,
and my daughters, just trying to share more of the private Al Gore.
Well,
you know, if you talk to anybody, I get credit for being funny and relaxed and spontaneous and private.
Yeah.
Criticized for being a little on the stiff side in public.
Yeah.
And that was just an attempt to say, look, here's the real Al Gore. Dig him.
Yeah. Okay,
but people took that the wrong way, and it was twisted, and it was spun, as everything gets spun these
days.
So I'm just back to being my public self and kind of letting my private self speak for himself.
Itself,
I mean, I'm still, what I'm trying to say is I wear casual clothes around the house, and I wear perfectly fine suits when I'm out in public, and that's what people expect. And it doesn't blur the message.
No, no, no. You know, but about the message, you're not still wearing the polo shirts, because we believe that is a look of the late 70s that is just so out of touch with today's idea of what it means to be the man. We think that there are casual treatments that just are so much more flattering, especially to the mature form.
Well, I'll certainly
Things don't have to be caftans or tunics. These can be...
Well, you know, it's funny, Mr. Blackwell. Yeah. When Tipper and I were writing the book, Joined at the Heart, I think for a good deal of the time, check me if I'm wrong here, Tip, I was wearing a Ritz-Carlton bathrobe that is somehow... I think one of the Secret Service fellas had brought it along
from
one of our trips.
Yeah.
And... you know, you can get addicted to just sitting around all day in plush terry cloth.
You can get addicted to sitting around all day in plush anything. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I am.
No.
You are writing in this book about the family.
Yeah.
And we would love to talk to you about the family, but can we talk, can we bring in Renee of London and talk about hair for just a minute?
Sure.
And specifically former vice presidential hair. Renee of London, Vice President Gore.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you. Pleasure is all mine.
Renee, we call Mr. Vice President, I think he'll be interested in this. We call him a magician with a pair of scissors. Renee, I want maybe for you to tell Mr. Gore and all the rest of us how security after the whatever has affected your line of work, your art.
Well, not really. I mean, women and men are more security conscious when I come to them and they come to me.
I would think so.
What I'm trying to get at is you can't travel with scissors. So as the magician with a pair of scissors, do you have scissors in every city that you must go to attend to your clientele? Or do you just re-equip each time you land, or what?
I check my tools. Just put him in check baggage. It's fine.
Okay, fine. Al Gore, the hair. Renee, what do you think? Do you think this is working? It's the same as it's been, yet it's not different enough.
Enough. I know what you mean. I'll tell you honestly. Yeah. Okay. I think there's a dignity to this man's hair.
Thank you.
And
interesting.
A down-to-earth quality that I wouldn't want to change.
I wouldn't want
to style that up.
No.
I wouldn't want to walk that upstairs, because
you
do that, and all of a sudden it's, Mr. Blow-Dry, Mr. Style. I followed your career enough, sir, to know that that's not the message you want to be sending.
Thank you. I really think, that all this focusing on hair and clothing maybe gets in the way of the message the ability to have a dialogue with the electorate that could move our country forward in a productive way.
I know it is sad, but I want to ask whether you think that what Dan Rather did when he just went so short and so boyish.
Mature boyish.
Do you think, Renee, of London, that this would be a look that could work for Al?
I think it could be jarring. I think it could be a little too much.
Too much.
Too late.
Too late.
We've just repositioned the part a little bit, but basically we've left it alone, and I think that's the way to go.
You know.
But
I think it is too, and I wish we could go farther with that and with everything else that's on our plates and in our laps. But the time, the clock time is catching up and is passing us and is leaving us in its wake, and we must awaken to it. Vice President Gore, Renee of London,
thank you.
I don't know where the time went, but we know that we want to have both of you back again.
Joined at the
next time on Strictly, the Spring Collections. What were they saying? Till then, Strictly from Blackpool. Bye bye.
Yakking right in my face, coming on acting like you own the place. The silence was golden, like you couldn't raise a dime. Cause your mind is off of chasing and your mouth is working overtime. You're quoting figures, you're dropping names, you're telling stories, you're playing games. You're overlapping with things ain't funny. You're trying to sound like you don't need money. Talk was criminal, you leave a life of crime. Cause your mind is off of kissing and your mouth is working overtime. Please, can you make it right? Cause your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime. Cause your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime. Cause your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, another copyrighted feature, the Apologies of the Week. I'm excited.
We're so sorry.
Keith Olbermann apologized to ESPN. Too long to read, but it's he apologized for being shirty at ESPN. Washington State Transportation Secretary Doug McDonald learned you can't kick Mississippi around after he declared Washington State, quote, the Mississippi of roads. I guess maybe I should have said we are the Bosnia of roads, he says, except that probably would just get me in trouble, too. He sent a letter of apology and some smoked salmon to the Mississippi Department of Transportation. A three-word comment attributed to an aide to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien of Canada dominated Canadian news reports Friday, with newspapers and broadcasts leading with the story of how the aide reportedly called President Bush a moron. Quote, "What a moron," is the quote attributed to François Ducrot, Chrétien's communications director, who reportedly was talking to a reporter about Bush in a private conversation at the NATO summit in Prague, the Czech capital, last time we checked. Other reporters who say they overheard the comment wrote about it in newspapers published Thursday. Chrétien, at his closing news conference Friday in Prague, said Ducrot offered her resignation because of the furor, but he rejected it. He also said she told him she was unsure if she made the remark, but acknowledged she uses the word moron frequently. Well, in Canada, I'm not... She may have used that word against me a few times, and I'm sure she used it against you many times, Chrétien told journalists, adding, "We don't live in as civilized a world as we used to, where private conversations are private." Chrétien said, when first asked about the reported comment, "Bush was not a moron at all. He's a friend." But they apologized nonetheless. "He's not a moron. He's a friend. He's not heavy. He's my brother." Same formulation there. It took 4 days, a contingent of federal and local investigators, and a lot of sleuthing, but the law yesterday, Friday actually, fingered the culprit who unleashed a cloud of pepper spray and shot part of suburban Pittsburgh into near panic. He's an octogenarian. He said he didn't mean to do it. He was just tossing out a mostly forgotten canister of semi-noxious gas he got in the military half a century ago. He's extremely regretful, according to the FBI agent who investigated the case. The man has not been charged. Regretful? I don't know if that's an apology. And finally, in the maybe it's an apology, maybe not department, Michael Jackson has admitted making a terrible mistake after dangling his 9-month-old son from a 5th-floor hotel balcony. You've seen the footage. Unless you're living in Osama's cave, you've seen the footage. I think Osama in the cave has seen the footage. Stunned fans watched in horror as Jackson, holding the baby with one hand, lifted him over the railings at the hotel in Berlin. The baby began to struggle before the singer, who was holding a white towel or cloth over the baby's head, pulled him back in and returned into the hotel room. In a written statement, the singer, who was heavily criticized by child protection groups, said, quote, "I made a terrible mistake. I got caught up in the excitement of the moment. I would never intentionally endanger the lives of my children." The child was Jackson's third and youngest, Prince Michael II. He also has an older child named Prince Michael. The existence of the baby was made public in August this year when he was reported to be 6 months old. Mystery still surrounds the identity of the child's mother and the question of whether the infant is adopted. The other two kids were also with Jackson on his German visit, and authorities in California have decided not to prosecute on child endangerment charges, fearing a negative precedent might be set if Jackson were found innocent. However, undisclosed until this moment is that the singer did agree as a community service gesture to record a song specifically warning against child endangerment. And here it is now.
The Shaw World exclusive.
Don't let him stare at the sun.
And with thanks to the people at Los Angeles Magazine for some very nice comments about the impending beginning of the 20th year of this broadcast, that will conclude this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week for the first broadcast of its 20th year from the Crescent City in New Orleans on these same stations on NPR Worldwide, on NPR Worldwide throughout Europe, on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the American Forces Network, on shortwave up and down the east coast of North America, WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, and on your computer, wherever you are around the world, at two locations, whenever you want it, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com, where the playlists are at harryshearer.com. And you know what? It would just be like having a towel over all of our heads if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.